Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Morningstar Men's Weekly Podcast, recorded live at our Saturday Morning Life Study. This week we're back in the series, What Would Jesus Say? And we're exploring the topic of relational stewardship. I think you're going to find this week pretty heavy in scripture. It's also going to be, frankly, a little bit convicting at times. But you know what? Sometimes what we read when we open up the scriptures is encouraging and uplifting. Sometimes it just calls us to task and says, hey, wake up. And I think this is going to be one of those wake-up weeks. Don't not listen just because that's the case. Just take courage, take encouragement in the fact that God doesn't call us to do anything that He doesn't also equip us to do. So listen along, if you will. Share this podcast with someone else who you think it may help. And as always, we'll see you again next week. So while we're waiting to get started and get everybody settled here, have you ever had lively conversations with your wife or your girlfriend? So my wife handed me this week. Well, actually, she emailed me this week. The Hormone Guide, How to Speak to Women. And it's divided into four categories. And it goes from dangerous to safe to safest to ultra safe. So here's the first one. Dangerous, what's for dinner? Safer, can I help you with dinner? Safest, where would you like to go for dinner? And ultra safe, here, have some wine. Next category, dangerous. Are you wearing that? Safer, you sure look good in brown. Safest, wow, look at you. And then finally, and you know where this is going, right? Ultra safe, here, have some wine. Dangerous, what are you so worked up about? Safer, could we be overreacting? Safest, here's my paycheck. And finally, here, have some wine. Dangerous, should you be eating that? Safer, you know there are a lot of apples left. Safest, could I get you a piece of chocolate to go with that? And then finally, here, have some wine. And then here's the ultimate, and every one of us should be able to appreciate this. Dangerous. So what did you do all day? Safer, I hope you didn't overdo it today. Safest, I've always loved you in that robe. And then finally, here, have some wine. All right, so we're going to move from silliness to, I hope, something of some practical value. Turn over, if you have a Bible, to Luke, the 20th chapter. We're going to look at the same basic story from three different vantage points. Most of you, I'm sure, have a basic understanding of the four Gospels. We're going to start in Luke. Now, Luke introduces his writing by saying, what I've done is gone out and I've gathered information from eyewitnesses. So what Luke does when he starts his gospel, he introduces it by saying, I personally am not an eyewitness to these things that I'm writing about, but instead, what I did for the benefit of this patron of mine, who may have even paid me to assemble this, is I have done the most diligent research possible. I've interviewed a variety of people, and what I've done is collect their stories and put them down into one comprehensive presentation. So when you read Luke, what you're looking at is the story of someone who was never an eyewitness to something, and so you're not going to see certain details. When you look at Matthew and Mark, you're going to see details that aren't there sometimes in Luke. But on the other hand, because Luke is gathering information from a broad variety of people who were eyewitnesses, you're also going to see things there that aren't in any of the other Gospels. So we start in the 20th chapter. We're going to begin at the first verse here. One day, as Jesus was teaching the people in the temple and preaching the gospel, the chief priests and the scribes and the elders came up and said to him, and before we get into what they say, let's look at where this is taking place. So this is right before Jesus' crucifixion. This is the final week that Jesus spends in Jerusalem leading up to ultimately his being crucified. And he goes back and forth between where he is staying outside the city and into Jerusalem. Every day he walks back and forth, and every day he does some form of teaching. Now, Luke doesn't go on into detail about that. You have to read that in other gospel accounts. But here these guys come up, three groups of people, priests, scribes, elders, and they come up to him and say, "Tell us by what authority you do these things. Or who is it that gave you this authority?" Well, what are the things that he's talking about? So if you look back and you just back up a few verses into the end of chapter 19, it says, "And he entered the temple and began to drive out those who sold, saying to them, 'It is written, my house shall be a house of prayer, but you have made it into a den of robbers.' And he was teaching daily in the temple." All right, well, just so that we have a clear understanding, now Jesus did this temple cleansing thing twice. Two different occasions, once in the early part of his ministry and once right here that Luke describes. He comes into the temple, which he describes as his father's house, and he sees that it's been turned into essentially a local shopping mall. And he's particularly offended by what he sees, and we'll get into that in a little bit more detail soon. But essentially it's this. You've taken this prime space that was to be available for people to come in and have private, quiet fellowship with God, and you've turned it into a mini mall. And you're selling things. And you're selling things at a high profit. You're actually gouging people. Have you ever gone somewhere where you needed foreign currency? When's the best place to get your currency exchanged? It's usually at a bank back home where you have time to shop for the best rate on currency exchange. When do you not want to have your dollars exchanged into something else?
When you're buying something, the guy in the corner says,
right. The closer you are to the foreign currency and the need for it, the poorer the exchange rate in your behalf. So when these people that are traveling for thousands of miles sometimes to be at the Passover, show up at the Passover, and they see these tables and they need, there's several things they need money for. They need money to pay a temple tax. The Jews have cleverly devised this so that they can't take the Roman currency, which is universally recognized. They can't take the Roman currency and pay the Jewish temple tax. So they have to take the Roman currency and exchange it for Jewish currency. Guess who makes out on that transaction? And then, if you're traveling for a long while, how many of you have ever gone on vacation and had to take a dog or a cat? Nobody? You want to leave them at home, don't you? All right, imagine you're a devout Jew and you're coming to the temple and you're going to need a sacrifice. You're going to need an animal. So if you left 1,000 miles away or 500 miles away and you're going on foot or you're going on donkey or however it is you're going, but it's not really, you don't just get on a greyhound or catch a flight. There's a lot of travel and a lot of lugging of things, so you probably don't want to take your cow with you for a sacrifice. Are you with me? So if you want to make a sacrifice in the temple, what do? You bring a bag full of loot and you buy the product locally that you're going to sacrifice. Remember the rule of exchange? The closer you are to where you need the foreign currency, the worse it is for you. And so Jesus sees this, and this is what these guys are doing. They're gouging the people furiously. And not only that, they're taking up prime temple real estate that should be accessible for people to worship. So imagine if like you came in, I don't know which direction you came in from, there or there. Imagine you came in there and you kind of had to like squeeze by between the tables where there were bake sales and the Girl Scouts were selling, nothing against the Girl Scouts, and the Boy Scouts were selling whatever Boy Scouts sell. And all this other stuff is going on. How would you feel? Give me a break, right? You'd walk through with one hand in each pocket just in case, right? Keep your hand over your wallet here, and just in case you had some loose change, right? You want to get through all this. This is what Jesus sees. And so he goes in there, and he turns it over, and he kicks the guys out. In John, it describes it like this. The Passover of the Jews was at hand. And remember, this is his first cleansing of the temple, not the one that we're going to read about in Luke. The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple, he found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons and the money changers sitting there. And making a whip out of cords, he drove them out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen, and he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned the tables. Are you getting a visual picture of this? Right? So there's livestock headed out of the temple. There's all of this currency just scattered all over the floor. tables at that time would not have been like nice plastic tables. It just would have been some rough cut plank with who knows what, some boxes holding it up, whatever. All that is just scattered all over the floor. And he told those who sold the pigeons, take these things away. Do not make my father's house a house of trade. All right. So we get the scene. So it says that this, leading up to this confrontation, again, last week, same festival, incidentally, this is Passover. Same festival as is described in John's account there a couple of years earlier. And he's teaching daily in the temple, and the chief priests and the scribes, and the principal men of the people. So when we read these stories, who do we think of as the bad guys? Right? You never cast Jesus as a bad guy, right? I mean, you've grown up knowing Jesus is the good guy. So you never assume that Jesus is making a stir, causing a controversy, or anything else. In our minds, it's been embedded. Jesus is the good guy, so who are the bad guys? If you grew up in church, if you heard any Sunday school stories, you know who the bad guys are. They're the chief priests, or the scribes, or the Pharisees, the Sadducees. These are the bad guys. We cast them in that lot. Well, the danger in stereotyping people like that is that sometimes who do we think of ourselves usually? I mean, when you place yourself into the story, do you ever see yourself as the bad guy? Of course not. You're always the good guy. Well, in that sense, you can never get a handle on these guys because these guys are the bad guys and you can't see your own qualities in them. But the tip-off here is the principal men of the people. Now, who are the principal men of the people? So we get the scribes and the Pharisees. We get all the religious guys, but who are the principal men of the people? Well, they're the business people behind the scenes that make the wheels in Jerusalem turn. Guess whose tables probably got overturned? The principal men of the people. These are the guys who made the money. Now, do you suppose that there were kickbacks involved? I suspect so. Do you suppose that behind closed doors there was payoffs made? Hey, listen, if I can set up my temple here, I'm going to give you a kick out of this. And listen, we're making so much money, we can afford to pay you a little bit. So there's all this stuff going on behind the scenes. Now, I want you to notice, these are the religious guys, right? The priests. Where do the priests live? Many of them stay at the temple. How do the priests make their living? They're working in the temple. What are the priests concerned about? Are they in any way confronting Jesus because they're concerned about the sanctity of the temple? They don't give a rip about the temple. They could care less. So when we see this, we don't see Luke describe it in those words, but here's what you do see when you read through these three accounts, and I'll point it out when we get to it. You see the gospel writers who write these stories years later. Not one of these Gospels' messages is written at the time when these events occur. The earliest one, we can guess, might have been written about 30 years after Jesus' crucifixion. So by that time, when they refer to this group of people, they refer to them as the Jews. Now, isn't that interesting? There's Mark writing, and he says, the Jews. There's Matthew writing, and he refers to them as the Jews. Well, what was Matthew? He was a Jew. What was Mark? He was a Jew. So when they describe these people as the Jews, they don't any longer see themselves as the Jews. They see themselves removed from this corruptness. Right, that was the introduction. Maybe we ought to get into the... But it makes more sense when you read it, doesn't it? If you understand a little bit of the backstory. And so one day Jesus is teaching and preaching. And the chief priests and the scribes and the elders come up and said to him, tell us by what authority you do these things, or who is it that gave you this authority? And he answered them, well, I will ask you a question. Now tell me, was the baptism of John from heaven or from man? And so they confront him with what we just said. Who gave you permission to do this? Who gave you the authority to do this? In a couple minutes, we're going to look at the essence of the two questions. Now, notice when they did this. What's the general rule if you're going to confront some and you want to do it graciously? When do you confront some? In a public setting or privately? And if you confront someone in a private setting, it's almost evident that you want the good for the other person and good for yourself. When you confront someone publicly, what's the motive? Shame them, humiliate them, make yourself look superior. So you can tell a lot about what their intent is by where they confront Jesus. If they had an issue with Jesus, they could easily have confronted him privately. They chose to confront him publicly because they want to discredit him in front of the people who are still listening to him. And the reason that they want to discredit him reveals a little bit about what's going on in their own hearts. And so they pose this question. Well, Jesus doesn't want to fall into the trap, and so he poses a counter question. And he says, I'll tell you what, I have a question for you. And if you are able and discerning enough to be able to answer this question, then I'll answer your question. And here's what he's saying. If you are spiritually sensitive enough, and if your hearts are not hardened to the extent that you are willing to answer this question honestly, then you've revealed to me that you could actually understand the answer that I'm going to give you. But if you can't answer the question I'm going to ask you, then it's already demonstrated to me that you don't have the spiritual sensitivity to even understand what I'm going to tell you. So he says, and they discussed it with one another. And here's what we say. They say, and he says, if we say from heaven, and this is about John the Baptist, remember, if we say from heaven, he will say, well, why did you not believe him? But if we say from man, all the people will stone us to death. For they are convinced that John was a prophet. And so after this little private huddle, they come back to Jesus, right? And somebody hears the private huddle. That's how we get these words. Somebody's standing on the sidelines, hears this conversation going on back and forth. And there must have been a little bit of amazement here. Incidentally, this story is told in three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. This same story is told. It got everybody's attention. And so they answered that they did not know where it came from. And Jesus said to them, well then, neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things. But there's a little line in here that we need to pay attention to. But if we say from man, in other words, if we answer him and say, well, this baptism of John the Baptist, this authority that he had, it was just from man. He made it up. All the people will stone us to death. Who are these guys? These are the priests, the leaders, the chief. Why would they be worried? If they had legitimate authority and power over the people, why should they be worried about the people stoning them to death? See, what they've just admitted is that they have such a tenuous hold on the people's attention. And incidentally, where are the people? Where are the people? Are the people flocking to hear the priests? Are the people flocking to be taught by the religious leaders, the scribes, who from the earliest that they could be taught, they were immersed in the scriptures? If anybody should have known the scriptures and should have understood the heart of God, it should have been the scribes, because they spent all day, every day writing the scriptures. Literally, they were immersed in it. How could they not know it? If you were going to be taught by someone, who would you logically be taught by? A scribe, because they knew the scriptures better than anybody else. But instead, these guys that should be in charge are what? They're jealous. They're jealous because everybody is flocking to Jesus and everybody is paying attention to Jesus and nobody is paying attention to them. And not only that, but they're actually, it says, scared. They're scared that if they give the wrong answer, the people are actually going to turn on them. Let's turn over to John 5. I hope I have this right. And if I don't, it was good for you to be able to find John 5 anyway. All right, here we go. Verse 19. So Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, the Son of Man can do nothing of his own accord, but only what he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, that the Son does likewise. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all that is in himself. And greater works than these will he show to them, so that you may marvel. For as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, so also the Son gives life. And so here's what Jesus is saying. All of this authority that I have, how do you think that I heal people? This is another setting. He's answering the question at a different time. How do you think that I have this authority? Where do you think this authority comes from? Just, do you think I, as just a mere human being, can heal people? Do you think that I can do all this miraculous stuff? Where is it that you think I get this power from? This is the same question that these guys are asking him. Where do you get this power from? What are they also concerned with? Okay, so let's say you did your job really well, or you were convinced you did your job really well. And some upstart from outside, so you've been working at corporate headquarters for the last 20 years. You're the insider of all insiders. And you consider that you do your job really well. And some, you'll forgive me, young snot comes in. He has no background. He has never done anything. He shows up at corporate headquarters one day and starts to make you look really bad because he's three times as good as you are at what you've done your whole life. How does it make you feel? How'd you get that good? Where'd that come from? I've spent my whole life learning this, and you know more than I did, and you're 22, 23. Where does that come from? You see the emotion that would... Let's be honest. How would you feel? Resentful? Irritated? Hurt? Angry? What do you do when you're the guy in charge and you're angry and resentful and hurtful? I mean, you can't just throw a temper tantrum, especially when you wear a robe and you're a priest. That's undignified. And so they try to have an intellectual duel, and Jesus calls them out on the intellectual duel. And then he goes back to his teaching. But here's the important point. Who do these people fear? They fear people. Remember Jesus' words? Don't bother fearing people, people who could take your life. Who do you fear? Jesus says. Who should you fear? It's not here. It's not in this. Who should you fear? Yeah, he says, don't fear people who can merely take your life. Fear the one who has the authority after life has been taken to decide your eternal fate. So what are these guys revealing right now? They don't know the one who holds that authority. Who do they fear? They fear the people more than they fear God. But they don't even understand that they've just said that. See, they've revealed to Jesus and to the people whom they really fear and where their allegiance is to. So who's your allegiance to if you fear for your own life? Anybody? Yeah, of course it is. That's your first and foremost loyalty. I am loyal to myself. That's the person I'm loyal to most. I mean, if there was a choice, if you could save yourself or save your child in a burning building, who do you save? That's a tough, right? But it reveals your loyalty, doesn't it? If you had to lay down your life in order to save your child, what do? That's a tough thing. Well, Jesus has just called them out and said, essentially, you're loyal to yourselves and to no one else. And then he began to tell this story. A man planted a vineyard and let it out to tenants and went into another country for a long while. And when the time came, he sent a servant to the tenants so that they would give them some of the fruit of the vineyard. We're going to remember, Luke does not go into a lot of detail. We're going to see this story told with more detail in a few minutes. But the story is absolutely preposterous. So as you read it here, what I'd like you to do is start to place yourself in the position of the owner of this vineyard. A man planted a vineyard, okay? Work involved. So think about something that you spent a lot of time building and let it out to tenants. Okay, so maybe you had a favorite house and then you're called away on business and so you have to rent out the house. You've invested a lot of sweat equity in this. You've invested a lot of finances in this. But because you're called away on business, you can no longer live in that house. But you don't want to give it up. And so you rent it out. And you go off into a foreign land. And when the time came, he sent a servant to the tenants so that they would give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. Well, that's expected. So imagine this house that you used to live in. It's your favorite house, but you can no longer live in it because you have to be away. And so you send somebody back to collect the rent check. And so suppose that the guy knocks on the door, but instead of being handed a check, they beat him up, kick him down the street, and he goes home bloody and bruised up. And he goes back to you, the owner, and says, you logically say, "Wow, you're looking pretty bad today. What happened to you? Did you trip on the sidewalk on your way?" And he said, "No, I have bad news. I didn't get the check." Not only didn't I get the check, but the people that you rented the house to, they beat me up. So just stop right there. We're all men. What do you feel like right now? What do you want to do right now? But listen, the story gets worse. But the tenants beat him and sent him away empty-handed. And he sent another servant. But they also beat him and treated him shamefully and sent him away empty-handed. Okay, so now twice you've tried to collect your rent. Twice. Civilly, honorably, you send somebody to collect the rent. Twice, they beat your representative up and send him back to you. Now what do you feel like? Come on. Is it starting to build up within you? That's why I ask you. Picture something that you felt you were entitled to a piece of. That you poured your heart and soul into. But they also beat him and treated him shamefully and sent him away empty-handed. And he sent yet a third. And this one they wounded and cast out. And then the owner of the vineyard said, "What shall I do?" Okay, you're the owner of your house. You're the owner of this thing. Okay, so this is your question now. What would you do? Three times you've tried to collect what was legitimately yours. Three times they've not only said, "No, I won't give you the rent." Not only that, but they beat up the people that you sent to collect it. Now these were prized servants. These were people that were loyal to you. As a matter of fact, these servants were probably your friends. So let's add another layer of complexity to it. Three times you've sent friends of yours who were able to travel, sent them to collect the rent, and all three friends came back beat up. What do you feel like? Here's the amazingness of this story. And he says, "I will send my beloved son. Perhaps they will respect him." But when the tenants saw him, they said to themselves, "This is the heir." In other words, in the end, when you die, this is your son. Okay? Your son is going to get this. Maybe that was part of the plan all along. Maybe part of the plan was that this beautiful home that you had built but could no longer live in, your son was going to have control over that one day. And so you send him to collect. Surely they'll respect him. He's not just a hired person. He's not just a friend. He's blood of my blood, bone of my bone. He's it. But what do the tenants say? He's the guy who stands to gain the most from this later on. Why don't we just kill him? Then there won't be anybody left and it can be ours. Let's kill him so that the inheritance may be ours. And they threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. What then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He will come and destroy those tenants and give the vineyard to others. When they heard this, they said, "Surely not." But he looked directly at them and said, "What then is written? The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone." All right, we're going to look at that also more. So, remember, Luke tells this story with brief detail. Let's now turn over to Mark 12. Same story. I hope you're good and worked up by now. So here they are. We're going to actually start at Mark 11:27. And they came again to Jerusalem. And remember I said that Luke doesn't fill us in on the fact that Jesus and his followers, every day they commuted back and forth between where they were staying outside of Jerusalem and into Jerusalem. And they came again to Jerusalem, and he was walking in the temple, and the chief priests and the scribes and the elders came to him. And incidentally, we don't necessarily see a contradiction there. Jesus could very easily have been talking and teaching at the same time as he was walking. Again, small details, nothing of any consequence. Whenever people insert, this is one of these parenthetical things that I'll insert. How many of you have ever watched a good cop show or a CSI, or right? When they go out and they interview all the different potential bad guys, no two of them have the same exact telling of the story, right? Because every eyewitness has a slightly different version of the story. They see it a little differently. They remember it a little differently. So here we have not really any contradiction, but rather two different people telling their story. Same question. By what authority are you doing these things? Or who gave you this authority to do them? So I said we would address this issue. What are the two questions that are being asked? The first one is power. That's the first authority question. How are you able to do this? How are you able to heal people? How are you able to, in fact, raise the dead? Because just prior to this, it says that Jesus has healed Lazarus. And when they saw that Lazarus was healed, a number of these guys that are probably involved in this confrontation right now, it says they made the determination right then and there that Jesus was to be killed. But they don't quite know how to do it. And so they say, how did you get this power? But the second question, and who gave you this authority to do them? Power and motive. How did you get to be able to do what you're doing? And exactly who told you that you should use this power to do what you're doing? Those are the two questions. Now, this seems like a real confrontation. But I have to remind you again, Jesus has essentially come into their house. Because they don't see that it's Jesus' house. They don't understand that the owner of the vineyard is actually back in the vineyard. They still think that Jesus is this schmuck from a small town. Small town? Schmuck from a small town? I said that, didn't I? Yeah, I did. Well, anyway, he's from a small town. It sounds very Jewish, doesn't it? And he's come to play in their house. And they don't yet understand who, hence the question. And they really can't bring themselves, give themselves permission to see what they might see, because what would it say? What would it say if they had to admit that all this time they had been treating the owner of the vineyard, God himself, badly? But they're given that opportunity, aren't they? And if anyone, who brings the confrontation? Is it Jesus who brings the confrontation? No. It's they who bring the confrontation. So right now, I want to pause on something before we go deeper into this. And this is the essence of this whole lesson. It's the principle of stewardship. Each of us has been given a little vineyard to tend to. It's not ours. So what I'd like you to do is think of the people in your life, the people that you come in contact with, the wealth that you manage, whatever else it is. Whose is it? Because over a period of time, do you think on day one, when the tenants took over the vineyard in that story that was told, do you think on day one that they thought it was theirs? Do you think on day one they all conspired together and said, you know, we're going to make sure that we get this for ourselves? No, on day one they were probably grateful to have an opportunity to work a vineyard. But what happens when you fail to regularly take inventory of what's been given to you and understand that it really isn't yours, it has been given to you? What happens when you start to act like the owner of something that isn't really yours to own instead of the steward of it? And what you see happening in the lives of these guys is not unique to them. So let's not find fault with them. Have you ever taken something of God's that was yours to manage and started to treat it as if it was yours to own and started to manage it in a completely different way because you forgot who gave it to you and why they gave it to you? And that's the danger that every one of us... So let's not find fault with these religious guys. Let's look into our own lives. Let's start at verse 12 here, or chapter 12 here in the beginning. And he began to speak to them in parables. Same story again. This time more detail. A man planted a vineyard, and he put a fence around it, and he dug a pit for a wine press, and he built a tower, and he leased it to the tenants, and went into another country. Okay, so what are the additional details that we see in the story? This time, same vineyard, but he puts a fence around it. What's that?
Protection.
Yes, it is. It's protection. And so here's what it's saying. And we're going to make this really applicable now. God carved out a special place for His people. He placed them in that special place. But He knew that not everybody was going to be enthusiastic about them being in that special place. And so He provided protection for them. He provided a hedge of protection around them. And He dug a pit for a wine press. So He also provides the means by which they're going to be able to use the land that they're in order to be able to thrive and prosper as humans. And He built a tower. What's the tower for? Now these are all common to a vineyard at that time, but what would have been the purpose to the tower?
Protection again.
Protection again. See who's on the outside that might want to come in, but also see who might have managed to get over the fence and is in and is now destroying the vineyard. And as a third thing, what else is a tower? It's also a way. Have you ever worked in a plant where there was a glass room upstairs where somebody could look out at you? It's also a way for those who are in charge, who are in management, to make sure that everybody is doing their job well. So a tower serves multiple purposes. So God provided everything for these people to thrive and to prosper. What does God want in return? In real life, what does God want in return? That's a question. That means you're free to answer now.
Be thankful.
There you go, to be thankful. But what's happening here in this story? When the season came, He sent a servant to the tenants. There's two other details that I want you to see here. It says the owner is not in the land. Does he still have his heart and his mind on the land and what's happening there? The answer is yes. How do we know that? Because He sends somebody back to the land, number one. Number two, because He sends somebody back to the land at the right time. See, if He didn't care about what was happening, when would He have showed up? Maybe at planting time? Well, what do you mean you're here for a piece of the harvest? It's the wrong time, you dummy. But God is not a dummy. And so He comes back at the appropriate time to get a share of the harvest. Now, how much does He want, incidentally? Does it say He wants it all? He says, listen here, you miserable wretches. I want you to work for the rest of your life. Your thankless, miserable, meaningless lives. I want you to work for the rest of those lives. And I want you to give me all the goods. That's not the story. He says, I would just like the portion that is mine. Your thanks, your gratitude, the tithe, whatever is mine, I would like mine. But I want you to prosper and thrive and do well also. Same details again here. They took him and beat him and sent him away empty-handed. Again, he sent another servant and they struck him on the head and treated him shamefully. And he sent another and they killed him. And so with many others. Some they beat, some they killed. And in this story, there's multiple people that come. And so who he's picturing here is all the prophets in times past that have come to issue reminders, to issue warnings, to say, God would like you to turn the focus of your attention back toward Him. He is the one who gave you this stuff. Would you please focus your attention back on Him? All right, it's time for another stewardship question here. Have you ever been called out by someone or challenged by someone? And instead of looking at your own heart, you got mad at them. Okay, so we don't beat and kill the person who irritates us. We're too civilized for that. We just seethe and simmer on the inside. Or we go off and pout. Or we never come back to hear them again. Or whatever it is. So when the messenger shows up to deliver the message, you have a choice. You can either know intuitively that the messenger comes on behalf of who? Someone who had a message to tell you. It's not the messenger's fault. So when a servant of God stands up and calls us to something or calls us away from something, we can either get mad at them or we can say, wait a minute. If this guy's heart is in the right place, then all he is doing what he was asked to do, exactly as God asked me to do, what I've been asked to do. And so finally, but those tenants said to one another, finally when the son comes, this is the heir, come let us kill him, and the inheritance will be ours. And they took him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. What then will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and destroy the tenants and give the vineyard to others. Well, this is the most scary part of this for them. Because they're starting to put the pieces together. He will give it to others. Remember John the Baptist? The question that started this whole thing when he wouldn't answer that? When they wouldn't answer that? What was John the Baptist's response when Jesus showed up? Remember what John says? Jesus must become greater and I must become less. So when Jesus is in the house, when God is in the house, when God is in the temple, His house, when God shows up back to the vineyard that He planted, what should be the response of the tenants who are there to manage the vineyard? Well, He should become greater and I should become less. It's interesting that Jesus uses that exact story, that exact thing to call them out. And so what He's saying is, you see the response of a true servant of God? The true servant of God recognizes when God is in the house and he makes less of himself and brings more honor and focus and glory to God. But when your heart isn't on serving the person that you claim to serve, then whom do you want the focus and the attention to be on? You want it to be on you, and whenever the focus and the attention is not on you, what do you get? Uptight, insecure, angry, right? Who are the crowds sitting and listening to? Remember what we said? They're not listening to the scribes teach. They don't give a rip about what the scribes say. They're all flocking to hear what Jesus says. Let's turn over to Psalm 118. Oh, well, while you're doing that, you go ahead. Psalm 118. And I'll read this part. So here Jesus says this again, the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. This was the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes, and He's using this to describe Himself. In other words, this important piece of the temple. All you guys are rejecting it. You want nothing to do with it. But instead, it is going to be the thing around which all the rest of the temple, new temple, is built. What's a cornerstone? I know we've talked about this here before, but just to refresh everybody's memory, what is a cornerstone? Anybody?
It's the first piece that serves as the guide for the rest of
that. That is it. The cornerstone is the most important single, and in a large, older stone building, there might have been several cornerstones. All the lines for the walls were based on where the cornerstone was set and how the cornerstone was set. In other words, the shape of the entire building is determined by the cornerstone. Now, Psalm 118. You're probably there. Just wait for me to get there. Since I don't hear any shuffling of pages, you've obviously been there a while. All right, so we're going to start at verse 19 of this psalm. Now, when Jesus uses these, He's not just using this statement as a figure of speech, but He's directing His listeners, and incidentally, the, quote, unwashed masses, the people that He was teaching, they might not have grasped the significance of this, but you can bank on it. That the scribes, remember I said, these guys who studied the Scripture morning till night, that wrote the Scripture day after day, these guys knew. So the principle was, if you were a teacher and you were teaching from one at a professional level to another at a professional level, all you needed to do was cite one or two key scriptures from something, and in the mind of those who already knew those scriptures, it brought back to memory all of that body of text. Do you understand what I'm saying? I mention the first verse or two of a chapter, the entire chapter comes to mind because these guys committed themselves to memorize large blocks of Scripture. So when he uses a couple of verses, he brings into their memory everything that surrounds those couple of verses. Verse 19, open the gates of righteousness that I may enter through them and give thanks to the Lord. This is the gate of the Lord. The righteous shall enter through it. You might want to hang on to that. This is the gate of the Lord. The righteous shall enter through it. I thank you that you answered me and have become my salvation. The stone that the builders rejected has become this cornerstone. This is the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. So what he's saying is that this thing that you're trying to overturn here, this thing that you don't want to happen actually, this is God's doing. This confrontation right here is representative of exactly what God is trying to do, and you're resisting it. Now, we think sometimes that these confrontations are intended to end badly, but they're not. Jesus is systematically trying to give them their last best chance to turn from what they're doing. And I know this is hard for us to believe. But there's texts in the Scripture that imply that things could have gone a different way if only these guys would have embraced this. Remember when Jesus is seen entering Jerusalem and he cries and he wails, I've given you chance after chance after chance. Even right now in this confrontation, they're still being given one last chance to turn their thinking, this could still go in a different way. Now it doesn't, and God knows it's not going to, and so all this is written down because God knows that it's not going to go there. But even now, the Son is still at your house. He's trying to collect the rent check. He's still there right now, and you haven't killed him yet. But you're ready to kill him. And he's saying, you still have a chance. Think about this. You could still get this. Turn over to John 10. Remember the gate and the righteous shall enter through it? I said pay attention to that. John chapter 10 verse 1. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door, but climbs in by another way, that man is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. He tells the same story from two different vantage points, but here's what he's saying first. He's saying, if you want to be a leader of people, if you want to lead sheep, and who does Jesus mean when he says sheep? People. If you want to lead sheep, you need to go through God's authority. If you try to climb in a different way, if you try to hijack that authority, if you take what wasn't yours to be, if you, instead of going through the door, instead of going through the doorway, which is through the authority of God, if you choose to climb over the wall to try to get it, what's going to happen? It's going to go badly for you. He's calling. This is all tied together. And to him, the gatekeeper, that is the guy who has God's authority, to him the gatekeeper opens. And then he says, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. And so there's a sense in which the people, remember, the people are all sitting there listening to Jesus. The people are not listening to the scribes. They're not listening to they don't care about them. What does Jesus say here? The sheep know the voice of their shepherd. Even though they don't know that, it's like at a subconscious level, it seems, they know who they should be listening to, even though they're not quite sure why. The common people that are here, and they've come from 1,000 miles away, 500 miles away, it's Passover. There are people here from all over. Let me put it a different way. This is like Christmas to them, okay? It's the one time a year when everybody shows up at church. And so this is their Christmas. And so all the people that are never in the temple any other time, all the people that only come to the temple for those special times when they are commanded to come to the temple, these people are all here. Where do the religious leaders want their focus to be, all these people that have come there? Where do they want their focus to be? On them, of course. This is like being the pastor of a 10,000 member church on Christmas and everybody's listening to the janitor and nobody shows up in the auditorium to listen to the pastor. How humiliating is that? Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door but climbs in by another way, that man is a thief and a robber. This is a stewardship lesson, so let's ask the tough question. Are you trying to take what isn't yours to manage? Do you know what God has given you? Do you know what God hasn't given you? Are you trying to manipulate and acquire to manage what God hasn't given you while you ignore what God has given you to manage? And that's a personal question. The only way that you finally arrive at answers to that is take time to get alone with God and actually ask the question, what is mine to manage? What have you given me to care for and how am I caring for? Now, time for personal confession here. I was moved to do this morning because, yeah, I don't always do this well. It's not as if some people do this really great and everybody else just does it badly. We all get this wrong. Like, if this table, and the surface of this table represents what is mine to manage, sometimes we only manage a small part of it and we ignore parts of it. Sometimes we ignore it altogether and we're over here trying to do something over here. And sometimes we really think the table's ours. And we just want to take the table and go somewhere else with it because we're pretty sure it's ours. So this week, what I'm going to encourage you to do, take some time to get alone with God, even if it's only 10 or 15 minutes at a time, even if it's your drive time, your shower time, whatever it is. Make a mental list. What are the things that God has given you to care for? And how are you doing with that? Here's the next list. Are the things that you're trying to go after that really, that's not what God wants for you? God has maybe given that to somebody else. That's not yours to manage, but you're trying to go after it. You're trying to manipulate and get into that on your own. Let's turn over to Matthew 21. I'll tell you what, before we actually start this section, it's the same story again. Are there any questions or comments? This would be a good break time. Have some interaction. Okay. Do you have anything else to add? That was kind of a final statement. Anybody else? Questions?
I like the fact that you said in the beginning about, you know, taking an inventory, like of our vineyard, I guess you could say, and then coming back to this last illustration. I think for me, you know, as I reflect, you know, sometimes I think we go in different stages, you know, and if we're not staying close to God and the Word, we might be over there rather than taking, you know, being a good steward of what God has given us. So it's, you know, it's kind of very important. The way that I see it is to stay as close as I can to God to just, you know, bring that reality. If not, you'll be over there, you know, in this section when you're supposed to be managing that. So that's, you know, really important. See that stuck out to me.
Maybe you've noticed how mixed our motives are. Thankfully, I think God gets that. Because sometimes we want to do the right thing for the right reason, and sometimes we want to do the right thing for the wrong reason, and sometimes we want to do the right thing, but we're really not sure why we want to do it, and it's some mix of the two. You know what I'm saying? And so, I don't want us to get so confused that we give up and don't do anything, because that's the other danger. Well, I can't tell why I'd be doing it, so therefore I won't do anything. So, for the sake of those whose lives depend on your management, do it while you sort out the motives. Right? If you need to make sure that the mortgage is paid, Don't worry about whether you're paying it for the right reason or the wrong reason. I would say for the sake of those who live in the house, it would probably be best until you sort out the motives that you just go ahead and pay the mortgage. And I realize that's an overly simplistic explanation, but honestly, there are certain things that are the right thing to do. Get working on figuring out why you're doing it and try to sort it out so that you get the right motives in the end. But keep doing the right thing in the meantime. Okay, I'm going to quickly read through this one last time. We are in Matthew 21. This is starting at the 23rd chapter. And when he entered the temple, the chief priests and the elders of the people came up to him as he was teaching and said, "By what authority are you doing these things? And who gave you this authority?" And remember, we've looked at those authority questions before. And Jesus answered them, "I will ask you one question. If you tell me the answer, then I will tell you by what authority I do these things. The baptism of John, where did it come from?" Go through the whole thing. So now we're going to jump down to verse 28. "What do you think? A man had two sons, and he went to the first and said, 'Son, go and work in the vineyard today.' And he answered, 'I will not.' But afterward changed his mind and went. And he went to the other son and said the same. And he answered, 'I go, sir.' But then later he did not go. Which of the two did the will of the father?" And they said, "The first." And Jesus said to them, "Truly I say to you, the tax collectors and the prostitutes go into the kingdom of God before you. For John came to you in the way of righteousness, and you did not believe him, but the tax collectors and the prostitutes believed him. And even when you saw it, you did not afterward change your mind and believe him." All right, so there's two points. For us as sons, how many of you figure that you've wasted part of your life? Right? I mean, that's... Were you stretching or was that two hands up? I'm not sure how many hands I saw there.
It was a stretch.
Okay. And the longer that a person feels that they've wasted their lives, I'm not going to use the language that would typically be associated with it, but there is that day where you say, who cares? I've made a mess of my life up to now. Why not just throw the rest in? What is the moral here of this two sons parable? That it's never too late to start to do the right thing. And are the prostitutes and the tax collectors, these wicked, evil people, are they rejected? Does God say, "Hey, you've screwed it up, forget it, it's too late, you're on your way"? No, he says, at whatever state in life, at whatever stage in life, you come to the realization that maybe you have squandered some of the opportunity that's been at whatever stage, it's not too late. How many representatives did the owner of the vineyard send out to collect the money? How many times did he give them a chance to do the right thing? Time after time after time. This is a big deal. Did you screw up yesterday? Did you mess up your opportunity to manage well yesterday? On your way here this morning, did you mess up your opportunity to manage well? It's not too late. What happened 5 minutes ago doesn't need to determine what you're going to do in the next 5 minutes, and that is a really powerful lesson. Even right here, in the week in which Jesus is going to be crucified, right up to the end, he is still trying to give these guys a chance to turn, to amend their thinking. This is just miraculous. So whatever we take away from this, and we're going to be done here, this is like record time. I don't think I've ever been done this quick. Oh, you're going to introduce something?
I'll take a couple minutes.
That's going to make me talk again then?
No, I just, you've been talking about these guys who, they were given something that wasn't theirs at all, just like we're given life, and talking about how they're being so selfish that they're beating people and killing the son who was set out to, you know, take a share of that. And I think that's, I look at it one way, the way you're describing it is, we should give back to God what it is, and we should pray about, you know, how we can be good stewards of what he's given us. But also, we just need to see, like, we should have the attitude, this isn't even ours, we should give it all back. We should be with the attitude of giving it all back. Even though God's not going to take it all back, it is his. I mean, our life is his. We should be in the mindset not to try to kill the son, but we should be we should be in the attitude, we'll give it all back, and, you know, whatever you're going to give to me, I'll take it. You know, I'll prosper and I'll use it wisely. But I don't know, just that is a different mindset. Like, okay, I'll take care of what you give me, but I will give you everything if that's what you needed. It's yours in the first place. So,
and how easy is it to slip out of that mindset? Like, how long will it take, honestly? And I'm going to single you out because you brought it up, but we can all leave here with that awareness of exactly what you said. How long does it take before you start to think like an owner instead of a manager again? 5 minutes? 10 minutes? See, it doesn't take long. So if you rely even on a once a week, well, I think I'll get my priorities straight once a week. Have you ever left here on a Sunday, or maybe this is your big deal for the week? Have you ever left here and you're going to change, you're going to live life differently? How long does that last?
Take it out of the parking lot.
And that's only if somebody doesn't cut you off in the parking lot, right? Seriously, my son goes down to Calvary, the big Calvary down, right? And so he parks cars once in a while. This is his statement. He says, "Christians are the worst. They are the rudest people. They come out of that service and they'll run you down if you don't get out of their way. They're blowing their horns in the parking lot. I mean, you'd think they just left a ball game instead of church," he says. So all I'm saying is, it doesn't last long if we don't almost daily, maybe even hourly, re-inventory. It doesn't take much time at all for us to lose our focus. All right, I could go on, but it would take us another half hour, and so I'm not going to do that. So I think I'm going to close here. I've given you enough to think on. You know, it's not like most weeks we need to know more. We just need to be reminded of what we already know. That's pretty much it.